award-winning human rights lawyer and director of the Gaza-based Palestinian Center for Human Rights. He's a recipient of the Right Livelihood Award and the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Award. We last spoke with Raji Sarani after Israel bombed his home in Gaza City. He joins us today from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Raji Sarani. If you could begin by talking about how you managed to leave Gaza and how you got to Cairo.
Well, it was very hard and very heartbreaking for me, I mean, to leave Gaza. I mean, the place I lived all my life and we took it in it. And that was very hard and very tough. But really, I mean, after I was targeted for the second time, after we talked, I was advised very strongly, I mean, not to be at the place and to leave, I mean, the northern of Gaza. And I lived with my family, who didn't want to leave me alone, I mean, there. So we left together to the south for a few days. And thanks for the help of great friends, I mean, who managed to get me there. Because in two previous attempts, it was mission impossible when tens of people died either on the beach road or at Salah al-Din Street in front of our eyes when the Israelis shot and bombed. I mean, people who were advised to leave to the safe haven in the south, but that wasn't, I mean, the case. So I managed, I mean, to leave to the south finally in my third attempt. And from there, I managed to move to Egypt. There was, I mean, quite a lot of friends who wanted, in a way, the voice, I mean, of Gaza, the voice of the voiceless, about the horrendous genocide taking place at that of the board to be reported, I mean, to the outside world. And there is quite a lot of things, I mean, to do with the ICC, which greatly disappointing us, and there is quite a lot of work to do with the ICJ, and there is quite a lot of work to speak to power in European countries about this new Nakba, which is in a process, and Israel creating it, and to stop their complicity, their absolute political, legal, military support for belligerent criminal occupation, who's doing suicide, genocide at the daylight, who's doing ethnic cleansing, war crimes, broadcasted there at live at the real time. But it seems deep in their mind and hearts, the colonial racist Western governments don't want to see, don't want to know, and they are insisting, I mean, in supporting blindly the Israeli belligerent occupation and the crimes they are doing in Gaza and the occupied territories at large.
Raji, if you could look straight into the camera lens as we speak to you now in Cairo, thank God you're okay. When we were speaking to you the day after your house was bombed, you described your son moving you and your beloved wife from one room, saying, let's go into the hallway, and then the place was destroyed. If you could say in more detail what it was like to make your way north to south, what you saw along the way. We also had reports that those who wanted to return to their homes north, so much of the bombing, it may surprise people, is happening actually in the south, where people are directed to go before the ceasefire. Is it true that people were shot trying to go home in the north? The Israeli military had said, don't do this.
Well, we have to understand the context. The context of what the Israeli really want. In simple words, Prime Minister Netanyahu, the criminal Netanyahu, said in simple words, Gazans should leave Gaza. He said Gaza should be deserted. And the Minister of Defense, Gallant, in a clear, simple way. He said, for Gazans, there will be no food, no electricity, no fuel, so what does that mean? I mean, if you say Gazan should leave Gaza, to go where to? It's obvious and clear. If you are starving and cutting electricity, food, medicine, you are bombing shelters, hospitals, ambulances, if you are killing hundreds of entire families, I mean being erased, if you are bombing bakeries, if you are bombing water infrastructure and desalination plants, if you are bluffing, I mean the entire streets in the Gaza, if you are not allowing people even to reach hospital, if you bomb the civil defense system and the people who are working on it, what do you want from that? If you make no safe haven in entire Gaza, what's the purpose of that? They want to push the north to the south. This is the first stage, and they pushed many as million people, I mean, to the south. Gaza already one of the most dense populated area on earth, and they pushed them while Gaza suffered 17 years of blockade, suffocated the life socially, economically, passed through 5 wars against them, and in the eye of the storm, the civilian and civilian targets. And now you are doing all that. You are killing almost 30,000 people, because many still, I mean, under the rebels, many still under their destroyed houses and civil defense unable to recover. You are talking about thousands of people. You are talking about thousands of people in the streets, in some areas nobody can get to. The rational, the behavior of the Israeli guidelines, the outcome of this, pushing people to the south, and then from the south towards Sinai. That's a new Nakba, as simple as that. They want us out of Palestine, out of Gaza, out of the West Bank. But this is, I mean, the ultimate goal, I mean, for the Israeli government and this coalition of Netanyahu and the right wing. The basis of their governmental agreement, the coalition agreement, to do that. This was said at day one of this war, of this genocide war. And I think, yet, the Israelis so determined, so willing, and they want to do that. They want to do that. They finished, I mean, the first stage, and now they want to go to the second stage. And after they finish up with Gaza, it won't be a new brand of apartheid in East Jerusalem and West Bank. They will do the same, I mean, there. So what was lack of their plan in 1948 in the Nakba, they want to implement it completely now. So Eretz Israel would be clean, and they will have the purity of the Jewish state. And by that, they will accomplish, I mean, their mission. This is simple, clear, for any who want to see beyond the details. This is really what Israel want to do. And that's why we call it, from the second day, this is genocide, this is ethnic cleansing, and these are first-class war crimes. It's against ABC of international law, international humanitarian law, and it's against Geneva Convention, it's against Rome Statute, and we see from the world to world support by many European countries doing that willingly and giving full legal, political, and military support for the state of Israel,
Raji,
plus
as, U.S. As you talk about international law, can you make that comparison between what happened in Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine immediately, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court opening an investigation, especially against children. I think there was something against what happened to the children. 500 children have died in Ukraine over almost 2 years, up to 1,000 dead or maimed. And you compare it to the few weeks of the bombardment of Gaza, 5,000 to 6,000 children alone dead, over 15,000 people dead. What do you want Karim Khan to do? And finally, and we just have a few minutes, right now, Blinken just met with Mahmoud Abbas. He just met with Herzog on his, fourth trip to the Middle East. The U.S. pushing hard to give more weapons aid to Israel. Your response to that? What do you want Biden to say to Netanyahu? And how much power does he have?
I don't think yet there is decision by U.S. to stop what is going on. They can simply stop all these crimes. We are bombed with F-35, F-16s, the American tanks, the American artillery, the American ammunition. We are killed with that, with some small amount of European arms. Now, if U.S. want to stop that, they can do that. And they can do that simply, but they are supporting, really what Israel is doing. And if we are talking about the next stage that Hello?
We can hear you fine. Just if you can look up into the camera. We see you. We may have just lost Raji Sarani. Raji Sarani is the world-renowned, award-winning human rights attorney, won the RFK, Robert F. Kennedy Award, won the Right Livelihood Award, has lived in Gaza for decades. Speaking to us from Cairo, Egypt, he just got out of Gaza. His home was bombed with his wife and his son and him in it. Next up, we're going to talk about Henry Kissinger. He's died at the age of 100. We'll speak to the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, Greg Grandin, author of Kissinger's Shadow. Stay with us. To Live in Peace by Victor Jara, the great Chilean musician who died in the days after the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet came to power. U.S.-backed, Nixon-backed, Kissinger-backed Pinochet, leading to the death of thousands. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Henry Kissinger has died at the age of 100. To many in the Washington establishment, Kissinger will likely be remembered as one of the most influential diplomats in U.S. history. but around the world, including in Chile, East Timor, Bangladesh, and Cambodia, Henry Kissinger is remembered as a war criminal whose actions led to massacres, coups, and even genocide. Kissinger, who was born in Germany, served as U.S. Secretary of State under Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford from 1973 to 1977. He also served as National Security Advisor from 1969 to 1975. He's the only U.S. official to ever simultaneously hold both posts. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1973 with his North Vietnam counterpart, Lee Duc Tho. During his time in office, Henry Kissinger oversaw a massive expansion of the war in Vietnam and the secret bombings of Laos and Cambodia, where as many as 150,000 civilians were killed in the U.S. strikes. As Kissinger told the military, quote, anything that flies or anything that moves. In South Asia, Kissinger backed the Pakistani military genocidal war against East Pakistan, which is now Bangladesh. In Latin America, declassified documents show how Kissinger secretly intervened across the continent, from Bolivia to Uruguay to Chile and Argentina. In Chile, Kissinger urged President Nixon to take a, quote, harder line against Chile's democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. On September 11, 1973, Allende was overthrown by the U.S.-backed general, Augusto Pinochet. Kissinger once said, quote, I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people.
In 1975, Henry Kissinger and President Gerald Ford met with the Indonesian dictator General Suharto to give him the go-ahead to invade East Timor, which Indonesia did on December 7, 1975. The Indonesian military killed a third of the Timorese population, one of the worst genocides of the late 20th century. Kissinger also drew up plans to attack Cuba in the mid-70s after Fidel Castro sent Cuban troops to Angola to fight forces linked to apartheid South Africa. At home, Kissinger urged President Nixon to go after Pentagon Papers whistleblower Dan Ellsberg, who Kissinger called the most dangerous man in America. The historian Greg Grandin once estimated Kissinger's actions may have led to the deaths of 3, maybe 4 million people. While human rights activists have long called for Kissinger to be tried for war crimes, he remained a celebrated figure in Washington and beyond, serving as an advisor to both Republican and Democratic administrations. We turn now to Greg Grandin. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor of history at Yale University. His books include Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. His new piece for The Nation is a people's obituary of Henry Kissinger. He also wrote the introduction to the new book just out, Only the Good Die Young, The Verdict on Henry Kissinger. Greg, welcome back to Democracy Now! So give us this people's history of Henry Kissinger. As we see in the mainstream media, he's hailed as the man who opened communication with China, led to a detente with Russia. What is your version of events?
Well, I think you summed up very well the version of events, the number of war crimes that he was involved in from. You know, Kissinger's life is fascinating because it spans a very consequential bridge in the United States history from the collapse of the post-war consensus, you know, that happens with Vietnam. And Kissinger's instrumental in kind of recobbling, recreating a national security state that can deal with dissent, that can deal with polarization, that actually thrived on polarization and secrecy and learning to manipulate the public in order to advance a very aggressive foreign policy. I mean, we can go into the details, but I do want to say that his death has been as instructive as his life. I mean, if you look at the obituaries and notes of condolences, they just reveal I think a moral bankruptcy of the political establishment, certainly in the transatlantic world, in the larger NATO sphere, just an unwillingness or incapacity to comprehend the crisis that we're in and Kissinger's role in that crisis. They're celebratory, they're inane, they're vacuous. They're really quite remarkable. And if you think of, just think back over the last year, the celebrations, the feting of his 100th anniversary, 100th birthday is living 200 years. I think it's a cultural marker of just how bankrupt the political class is in this country is. So his death is almost as instructive as his life.
Well, we had you on, Greg, when he turned 100, when Kissinger turned 100. In that interview, you said that the best way to think about Kissinger isn't necessarily as a war criminal. Could you explain why?
Yeah, because that is the way. I mean, Christopher Hitchens popularized in thinking about him as a war criminal, and that as a way of elevating Kissinger in some ways as somehow an extraordinary evil. And it's a fine line, because he did play an outsized role in a staggering number of atrocities and dealing misery and death across the globe to millions of people. But there's a lot of war criminals. I mean, you know, this country is stocked with war criminals. There's no shortage of war criminals. And thinking about him as a war criminal kind of dumps us down. It doesn't allow us to think with Kissinger's, use Kissinger's life to think with, to think about how the United States. For example, Kissinger started off as a Rockefeller Republican, you know, a liberal Republican, an advisor to Nelson Rockefeller, who thought Nixon was far out of the mainstream and a dangerous sociopath, I think, as he put it. And yet when Nixon won, and he actually helped him win by scuttling a peace deal with North Vietnam, he made a speech with Nixon, and then he went on, you know, into public office. Then he thought Reagan was too extreme, and yet he made a speech with Reagan. Then he thought the neocons were too extreme, and he made a speech with the neocons. Then he even made a speech with Donald Trump. He called Donald, he celebrated Donald Trump almost as a kind of embodiment of his theory of a great statesman being able to craft reality as they want to through their will. So you see Kissinger, as the country moves right, you see Kissinger moving with it. So just that trajectory is very useful to think with. If you also think about his secret bombing of Cambodia, yeah, and then trace out that bombing, it's like a bright light, you know, a trace of red running from Cambodia to the current endless war on terror. What was considered illegal? I mean, Kissinger bombed Cambodia in secret because it was illegal to bomb another country that you weren't at war with in the 1960s and 1970s. His old colleagues at Harvard, who were all cold warriors, none of them peace liberals, marched down to Washington. They didn't even know about the bombing. They went to protest the invasion of Cambodia. And now, you know, it is just considered a fact of international law that the United States has the right to bomb countries, that third-party countries that we're not at war with, that gives safe haven to terrorists. It's just considered commonplace. So you could see this evolution and drift towards endless war through Kissinger's life. You could also, Kissinger's life is also useful to think about how, you know, as a public official, first National Security Advisor and then Secretary of State to Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford, Kissinger created much of the chaos that would later necessitate and require a transition to what we call neoliberalism. But then out of office, as the head of Kissinger Associates, Kissinger helped broker that transition to neoliberalism, the privatization of much of the world, of Latin America, of Eastern Europe, of Russia. So you see that, you know, that transition from you know, a politician or public policy maker, and then going on to making untold wealth as a private citizen in this transition. So you know there's many ways in which Kissinger's life kind of maps the trajectory of the United States. You know, they celebrated him at the New York Public Library as if he was the American century incarnate. And in many ways, he was. You know, he really, his career really does map nicely onto the trajectory of the United States and the evolution of the national security state and its foreign policy and the broken world that we're all trying to live in, as your last two statements,
Greg, showed some. I want to go to Henry Kissinger in his own words. He's speaking in 2016 when he defended the secret bombing of Cambodia.
Nixon ordered an attack on the base areas within 5 miles of the Vietnamese border that were essentially unpopulated. So when the phrase carpet bombing is used, it is, I think, in the size of the attacks, probably much less than what the Obama administration has done in similar base areas in Pakistan, which I think is justified. And therefore, I believe that what was done in Cambodia was justified.
So that was Henry Kissinger in 2016. He was speaking at the LBJ Library. The late celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain once said, "Once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands. You'll never again be able to open a newspaper and read about that treacherous, prevaricating, murderous scumbag sitting down for a nice chat with Charlie Rose or attending some black tie affair for a new glossy magazine without choking. Witness what Henry did in Cambodia, the fruits of his genius for statesmanship, and you'll never understand why he's not sitting in the dock at The Hague next to Milosevic." If you can just respond to that.
That quote contains more moral and intellectual acuity and intelligence than the entire political establishment, both liberal and both Democrat and Republican. It's a morally correct, it's intellectually correct, and it's more accurate than most diplomatic historians who trade on making Kissinger more ethical. Morally complicated than he was. In terms of Kissinger's quote himself about Cambodia, there he's playing a little bit of a game. So he's lying. I mean, he carpet bombed Cambodia. The United States massively bombed Cambodia and brought to power within the Khmer Rouge the most extreme clique led by Pol Pot. You know, when you massively bomb a country and you destroy all opposition, you tend to bring to power the extremists, and that's exactly why Kissinger is responsible to a large degree for the genocide that happened later on under Pol Pot. The bombing brought to power Pol Pot within the Khmer Rouge, which previously was a larger, broader coalition. But Kissinger isn't wrong when he links it to Obama's bombing of Pakistan. That was the point I was trying to make earlier. You know, Kissinger just had to do it illegally, covertly back then, because it was illegal. It was against international law to bomb third countries, in order to advance your war aims in another country. But now it's accepted as commonplace, and it is true. He's not wrong when he cites Obama's drone program and what Obama the continuation of the logic of the war on terror that started under George W. Bush. He's not wrong about that, and that's the line that's one of the lines that you can trace from Vietnam and Cambodia and South Asia to today's catastrophe that we're living in.
Greg Grandin, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize winning author and professor of history at Yale University. He's author of Kissinger's Shadow, The Long Reach of America's Most Controversial Statesman. We'll link to your article in The Nation, A People's Obituary of Henry Kissinger. Happy belated birthday to Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM. Broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.